So I'm in the study of Miki Sotharakis, waiting to meet him. I have to describe the room for you because it's the most amazing space. There's the desk, it's covered in sheet music. There's a piano, which has got books stacked high and sheet music on it as well. And then above the piano is something that looks a bit like an astrological chart, a white sheet of paper, a metre and a half by a metre. It's covered in starbursts of lines, and at the end of the lines, the various pieces of music, the titles are written, and it's almost like a kind of map which shows how, for him, all of these pieces are interconnected. And there's two major parts to it, really. One is the classical works, which are up towards the top left, and then over on the bottom right, there's the epitaphios, song cycles, and the axionisti. And then there are other pieces which seem to sort of float up towards the top right, the suites, Canto Olimpico, which is the piece that he wrote for the Olympic Games. And by his chair, there's a painted portrait of Lenin, there's a bust of Joseph Stalin, a small plaster bust of Che Guevara, as well as a portrait of Mao Zedong. There's a printed black and white photograph of his father, Yorgos Theodorakis. And on his desk is what seems to be a work in progress, sheet music, which at the top says La Passion de la Lune, which looks like it's something that he's working on right now, the rubber and pencil ready next to the music.
If you had one composer to speak about in his total amount of work who represents Greece as a whole, is Mikis Theodorakis.
It was great moment. It was a big boom in politics, in social, in art. It was fantastic.
Theodorakis created a world of his own, ideas that could serve really as a basis of reconsidering Greek music.
Mikis Theodorakis is Greece's greatest living composer. In many ways, his story mirrors that of modern Greece, part of the resistance during the Second World War, imprisoned and tortured during the Greek Civil War, exiled during the military dictatorship. And in a career stretching over 60 years, he's been responsible for a musical revolution, a uniquely Greek sound. He was born in 1925 on the island of Chios in the Aegean. His father was from Crete, but his mother's family had recently arrived from Smyrna in Turkey, refugees from the Asia Minor disaster of 1922.
Την εποχή που ήμουν, πέρασα τα πέντε χρόνια και τα οποία θυμάμαι ορισμένα, μέναμε στην Λέσβο.
From what I can remember of my first 5 years, we lived on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean. My mother's family were from Smyrna, so the first songs I heard were from Asia Minor, and often they were laments, as they cried all the time for their lost home. I was also very lucky in that my uncle brought me a gramophone and some records. One was of Greek songs, what we call demotic music, basically regional folk songs. But the most important thing of all is that from a young age I listened to Byzantine music. My grandmother on my mother's side was a very religious woman. She lived with us, and everywhere we went she set up a room as a chapel with her icons and incense. And with her, I learned to sing all the Byzantine hymns. That's probably the music that influenced me the most. Here in Greece, we weren't used to hearing harmony, because our music is basically monophonic. The first time I heard Western-style harmonization was when we moved to Kefalonia. But in all the other places we lived, Chios, Lesbos, Syros, music was monophonic.
Growing up in this monophonic world left a deep impression on his music. This is one of his first compositions, a setting of the Troparion of Kasyani. It's a hymn that's traditionally sung during Holy Week, and Theodorakis dedicated it to his local church in Tripoli, where he led the choir. It was 1942, and he was 17.
Greece was under German occupation, and we used to go and see films. One of them contained Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy. It had a huge influence on me, because unlike everything I'd heard up to that point, it had a choir in it. So in that sense, I understood it. But it was also the first time I'd heard a full symphonic orchestra. My family had decided that I was going to become an architect because I was quite good at maths. But after hearing the Ninth Symphony, everything changed.
Piraeus Street, or Athos Piraeus, is one of the busiest streets in Athens. It leads from the centre right down to the harbour in Piraeus. And I've come here to visit a building which today is the National Theatre School, but back in the 1940s, it was the old Athens Concert Hall. It's an absolutely gorgeous turn-of-the-century building. As soon as you come in, there's an old wooden staircase leading to the upper floors. And just off to the right, there's what was the old backstage door. Well, I'm standing on what was once the stage, looking out into where the audience would have sat, and there's just one upper gallery which would have held maybe two rows of seats. Well, it's here that Mikis Theodorakis learnt to play percussion and so took part in the symphony orchestra. And it's here that, with the library that was attached, he pored over scores of symphonies and concertos and operas. And it was here that he also wrote much of his chamber music. The first part of the first sonatina for piano and violin, composed in around 1943. At the time, Theodorakis was a student at the Athens Conservatory. He studied violin and piano and played percussion in the orchestra, but it soon became clear that his real talent lay in composition. Yorgos Themerdzis is a violinist and member of the New Hellenic Quartet.
I am myself surprised on how demanding his violinistic works are. I consider his second sonatina for violin and piano, even the first, but especially the second, one of the most demanding works written in Greece.
Thank you.
Theodorakis' characteristic was some kind of modality, and in the early days, before turning to being more popular, where he started to soften his harmony. His initially musical writing was bold enough. You can see the influence of Prokofiev. You can see the influence of Shostakovich. You can see the influence of the French modalists. The post-war music was already very revolutionary in matters of the language being used. Mikis chose the extremely other way of Nikos Kalkotas. Nikos Kalkotas was one of the guys that adapted, say, modernity in matters of atonality. Mikis said, no, music should be tonal. But of course, tonal does not mean the traditional way of, say, the national school. He got, on the very, very first moment of his serious output, a unique way, a personal way.
As the Second World War drew to a close, in Greece another conflict had only just begun, the Civil War. Theodorakis had been part of the resistance to the German occupation, and like many partisan fighters, he was a communist. But now the Allies decided that Greece was to be part of the Western Bloc. In 1944, the newly formed unity government collapsed, and on the 3rd of December, troops opened fire on demonstrators, leading to over a month of full-scale conflict. The communist partisans, alas, on one side, against the combined forces of the Greek government and the British army on the other. Theodorakis, together with a young architecture student, later a composer, Yannis Xenakis, took part in the famous Battle of Makriani, fought in the streets below the Acropolis. Xenakis became one of the most important modernist composers of the century. Theodorakis' music was unrelentingly tonal. He kept to the traditional methods of composition, and yet he always managed to sound different. In 1947, he was arrested as a communist and exiled to Ikaria in the Aegean, and there he began work on his first orchestral composition. By the time he was transferred to the government's re-education camp for political prisoners at Makronisos, he had already written his first symphony.
I had it in a suitcase, about 300 pages, but the guards wouldn't let us take our things up to the tents because they wanted to search them first. There was a terrible blizzard, about gale force 9, and our tents were carried off into the air. It lasted 4 days and four nights, with no food, no water, huddled against one another for warmth as it was freezing, a real snowstorm. When we finally went down to collect our things, I saw the whole of my symphony scattered by the wind. The pages were caught on the barbed wire fence. Luckily, I could remember some of the themes, and so I started to write it out again from scratch. So again, I had it in its suitcase, another 300 pages worth of music. We were running, and as we were running, they were beating us. I was holding the suitcase on top of my head, and so they beat me on top of my hands. I couldn't stand it any longer, and I threw the suitcase over the cliff. The wind took it, and all my papers blew out to sea. There was a man there whose speciality was to wrench out limbs, and he dislocated my leg at the knee. And of course, by that stage, I had tuberculosis. I almost died. And so that I wouldn't die there in their hands, they shipped me back to the military hospital in Athens.
Και μας πήγαν στο 300 νοσοκομείο.
But this wasn't the end of the nightmare. Theodorakis was returned to Makronisos to face worse. Eventually, on the verge of death, he managed to send word to his father, who was able to arrange safe passage to Crete. There, hiding in the mountains, his leg was fixed by an uncle, a shepherd whose only medical experience was in setting animal bones. Slowly, he began to recuperate, and in the spring of 1950, he was able to return to Athens to pass his final exams at the conservatory. 4 years later, with his scholarship in hand, he left for Paris to study under Olivier Messiaen and Eugène Bigot. With a bit of money in his pocket and free from the terrors of the Civil War, he began to write in earnest, and there was a wonderful breakthrough in 1959. Although it was never recorded, his ballet suite, Antigone, was performed to great critical acclaim at Covent Garden by a cast including Rudolf Nureyev.
The Queen Mother was there, together with the Queen and the nobility. They were all in black tie, the ladies with their tiaras. But when I saw all these aristocrats, I thought, what on earth am I doing here? Am I writing music for them? I mean, they were perfectly good people, educated and all the rest of it. But I wasn't writing for them. I was writing for ordinary people, and most of all the Greek people. So I said to Mirto, it's over.
Yes, Mirto. Τελειώσαμε.
Μέρα Μαγιού μου μίσεψες, μέρα Μαγιού σε χάνω. Άνοιξη που αγάπαγε. Το φως της οικουμένης. Άρμεγες με τα μάτια σου. Το φως της οικουμένης.
The song cycle Epitaphios, or The Epitaph, is based on a series of poems by Yannis Ritsos. He got the idea from a newspaper photograph of a mother mourning her dead son, a tobacco worker killed in a strike for better wages. Mera Mayu is a mother's lament, in old-fashioned folk verse. But Theodorakis set it to the subversive sound of Rebetiko, with its asymmetrical meters and harsh bouzouki melodies. He hired the legendary bouzouki player Manolis Chiotis, and his vocalist was Grigoris Pithikodzis, a nightclub singer of laiki musiki, a popular form based on Rebetiko. All this was a far cry from Covent Garden, and Theodorakis seemed to be turning his back on the music that had brought him his greatest success. Why?
That why is, I think, the key to Miki's personality. It has something to do with he himself as a person. He never stays where he is. He always wants to go one step forward. He revolts to anything that is there. He doesn't want to stay one single moment in what he did.
Today it's hard to appreciate the furore surrounding Epitaphios. Imagine Benjamin Britten writing a rhythm and blues album for Mick Jagger using poetry by Ted Hughes. But the years immediately after the Civil War were marked by a collective obsession with Greek identity.
The thing that really got people going was the bouzouki, whether it was a Greek instrument or a Turkish instrument. I was invited to speak at various places. The American Girls' School, the Pontic Social Club, student organizations, even the police academy. I used to explain that instruments can't have a national identity or a homeland. If the bouzouki expresses us, then it's Greek. Eventually this was accepted, particularly as the poetry was also Greek. So a struggle began for Greek identity that was led by composers, not just me, also Manos Hadzidakis and Tsitsanis, the great songwriter and bouzouki player. I think we really helped to give people what they yearned for, something completely their own.
να έχει κάτι τελείως δικό του.
Στο περιάλι το κρυφό κι άσπρο σαν περιστέρι διψάσαμε το μεσημέρι μα το
These songs may have been challenging at first, but they were really embraced by ordinary Greek people. Songs like Arnisi, based on the poetry of Nobel laureate Yorgos Seferis, are practically national anthems. Theodorakis built on this success with classics like the irresistible Zorba. But at the same time, he remained politically engaged. He wrote the soundtrack to Zed, a film about the murder of a left-wing MP by right-wing extremists, and he founded the Lambrakis Youth Movement in the MP's memory. At the same time, he was preparing yet another musical revolution.
I could no longer remain just a symphonist or just a songwriter, so I decided to create new formats so people would get used to hearing symphonic arrangements, because most people weren't familiar with that kind of music. They didn't particularly like it. I call this new kind of music metasymphonic music. In other words, a music that goes beyond European symphonic music and is our own Greek symphonic music.
Έσπηρε κόσμους μικρούς κατ' εικόνα κι ομοιοσύμου.
Έπεσε στα χέρια από τον αξιονιστή.
Ελίδης had just finished writing his masterpiece, The Axionisti, and he suggested that I couldn't turn it into songs, as it was, in his own words, a liturgy. Greek liturgy has three elements. First, there's the priest, who sings alone. Then there are the psalters, or choir, who sing in unison. And finally, the deacon, who speaks the gospel.
This structure holds an otherwise disparate piece together. The modal symphonic passages, the chorales, the Byzantine prosody, even whole passages of popular songs, the laiki musiki, once more sung by Bithygodzis. It's a complex work, but it's one of Theodorakis' most enduring successes.
There was a long queue outside this record shop, and in the queue I could see a man with a mule. So I went to the last person in the line and asked what they were all waiting for. He said, Axionisti has just come out and we're waiting to get it. So I went up to the man and asked him why he was there. He said, my village sent me. They heard that Theodorakis' new record was coming out and they sent me here to get it. That was exactly what I wanted. I wanted that villager. I wanted him to come and get the record and bring it back to his village. And I achieved it. And I said, that's it. I don't want anything else from life. I've succeeded.
No, I don't want anything else. I've succeeded.
The unmistakable Maria Farandouri. Theodorakis heard her singing while she was still at high school and insisted that she become the priestess of his music. She sung his setting of Pablo Neruda's Canto General, as well as the politically charged ballad of Mauthausen, written especially for her voice.
In 1963,
the troubles started. Because that decade saw the flowering of a cultural and artistic movement that was also political in nature. There were student demonstrations, fights, people were asking questions. A new era was opening up, and artistic expression went with it. Theodorakis' music immediately became part of the struggle, and he went into hiding. He left me a note saying, "Go. Take an orchestra, take the musicians, and go abroad. There is no hope here." So, one by one, we all left and went to Paris.
Tenor Marios Frangoulis was a young boy living in Athens when the dictatorship was declared.
I remember, you know, living in Ambelokipus, and I could hear the tanks outside our building, and we had our shutters, you know, down. Because we didn't know what was going to happen, whether it was going to be dangerous for us or not. It was a scary moment, and Mikis Theodorakis gave us the encouragement to feel that we can overcome this. And Mikis Theodorakis was so international, and of course because of Zorba the Greek, and everybody knew who Mikis was, people paid attention to what he had to say.
And Mikis was very vocal. By special decree of the colonels, his music was banned, and the whole family was exiled to Zatuna, a remote village in the Peloponnese. But he still managed to get his resistance songs smuggled out, on tape sewn around the buttons of an overcoat. And so he was imprisoned in Oropos, a sleepy seaside town about 40 kilometres from Athens.
I'm just going into the main building now. Today it's a school and there are children here practising their music. They very kindly let me into one of the practice rooms to have a look.
Yes,
yes. Well, Kyria Palamidi has very kindly agreed to show me the actual cell where Theodorakis was kept. I've gone outside the main building of the school. And this is the actual room. Well, the door's closed behind me and I'm here by myself. The room's not huge, it's about 5 metres, maybe by 2 or 3 metres. There are two very high windows which are blocked up, so there's almost no natural light at all unless the door's open. Today there's central heating, which there wouldn't have been then. It would have been absolutely freezing in winter and very damp because we're right by the sea. It's a concrete floor. which is quite calm to the touch. And the door is the same door. It's a metal door, very high and wide, with a small gap in it that you can just about open so that somebody can look inside, and then something almost shaped like a letterbox where presumably you can pass a plate of food through. And unlike Valarakis, I can actually open the door and come back out whenever I want.
Στον άλλο κόσμο που θα πας, κοίτα μη γίνει σύννεφο.
While I was at Oropos, Κυρία Παλαμίδη told me a story. In 1970, rumours were going round that Theodorakis was going to be executed. And so his old friend Manolis Hiotis got together a group of musicians, commandeered a dinghy, and rowed it right up to the perimeter fence. Mikis was walking in the yard, and he heard someone singing Rodostamo, the song they had played together. The song is about the death of a lover. I gave you rose water, you gave me poison. That night, Hiotis went home and died of a heart attack. Theodorakis escaped execution. By arrangement with the junta, he was smuggled out of the country to Paris, where he stayed until the dictatorship fell in 1974.
I went back to Paris and shut myself away. I stayed there almost 20 years. And from 1980 to the late 90s, I began my new symphonic period. That's when I wrote the second, the third, the fourth, the seventh symphonies. I wrote a requiem. I turned Zorba into a ballet suite. And I also wrote a national anthem for the Palestinians at the request of Yasser Arafat. But while Zorba was being performed in Verona, played together with Verdi's Aida and Puccini's Turandot, I decided to write three operas. One dedicated to Verdi, Medea. One for Puccini, Electra, and one for Bellini, Antigone. Each opera takes about 2 to 3 years to write, so it was as if I dived into the sea here and not resurfaced until Smyrna.
Oh,
somebody can already hear that there is a slight change in his style. His harmony has changed. There is a lot of influence from his popular period. Miki's thematic material served both his classical works and his pop songs. As somebody can see in his own house, where he has an astrological map with his thematic material, although the form and the material used is once more extremely classical. So Miki's once more goes on with what I think intended when he became a composer, become a really classical, large-scale composer.
The story goes that they had dinner together. Constantine expressed his admiration for Mikis's work, and the two became friends.
The second part of the story is during the actual Olympic Games of 96 in Atlanta, where Constantine was once more there, and he decided to make a cruise in Caribbean. Fidel Castro heard that King Constantine is nearby. He asked him for a dinner, and during that dinner, of course, the conversation went to his close friend, Mikis, the revolutionary, and then Constantine said, but he's also my own friend. And so Fidel asked King Constantine to bring a box of cigars to Mikis, which Constantine did with great pleasure. That box lies there as a symbol of the global importance of Mikis himself, something that he himself enjoys that tremendously. It's like discovering, say, Tutankhamun's grave. The biggest surprise is the now numbered as fourth quartet. We prepared that material, we start practicing it, until one day I got a call from a publishing company that we should go there and pick the parts. I said, how is that possible? We kept his urtext. Did he revise the text of 45? We took those parts and we tried them, and then we found that this is another piece. All harmonies were softened, and I must say the magic of that early piece was lost. So we presented to him the urtext, say, that is the version of 44-5. He was extremely happy. And then I told him, now listen to your revision. We could not play more than 7 bars. He stopped us and said, please keep the other one. And then I asked him, why did you do that? And his answer was like a boy, that his mother would blame him for some bad thing. And he said, I was not afraid when I was young. I am afraid now.
With the 3 albums of chamber music recently recorded by the New Hellenic Quartet, it's clear that there's more to be discovered. So whether Mikis Theodorakis's true legacy is as an international classical composer or a popular Greek songwriter remains to be seen. But the works speak for themselves, a varied and original oeuvre that reflects a willful insistence on finding and expressing a uniquely Greek sound. Perhaps the fierceness of the debate that surrounds him is an indication of his centrality.
It's true, there is a part of the classical music world in Greece that never accepted Mikis. Maybe that is the cost that he is paying now. There's no doubt that if, say, a symphony of Mikis is presented in the Athens Concert Hall, fewer people will come to listen to it. In comparison with, say, an evening in Herodion where you have 5,000 people or even more wanting to be there. The serious so-called music scene in Greece never forgave him for what he did by turning to his popular stuff.
Μα είναι απλό πράγμα και εμένα να σου πω.
It's a very simple thing. Even I, if I'm here during the day and want to relax, I prefer to listen to my popular songs. I have all my music on my iPod, and I put it on to where it says shuffle and just listen. Because the songs have a directness, a humanity about them. The classical works require a certain level of understanding and concentration. So I understand people's preference for the popular works.
If Mikis had not written this music, and if we didn't have all the things that Mikis inspired, the political movements, the artists, the students, today we would have a different Greece.
We all love Mikis because he's part of our upbringing, part of our childhood, and we want to be able to give this and pass this knowledge on to the younger generations.
I think now we have to consider that Mikis Theodorakis is maybe the central figure of music in Greece, the last of the great musicians.
Radio 3's Chekhov season continues this weekend with a new production of a classic drama and an unusual challenge.